Welcome to episode 3 of Counting to 5, a weekly podcast about the United States Supreme Court. On today's episode, we're going to look back at the oral arguments the court heard in 5 cases this past week, and then we'll take an in-depth look at the 3 cases that will be argued this coming week. Let's dive right into last week's oral arguments. The court heard arguments in 5 cases on October 4th and 5th, and we're going to take a look at each of them, highlighting some of the key arguments and exchanges as we go. In last week's episode, I gave an in-depth preview of each of these cases. If you're not already familiar with these cases, I highly recommend you check out episode 2 to give you the background you need to better understand the oral arguments. The first argument on Tuesday, October 4th, was Bravo Fernandez v. United States. This is the bribery case out of Puerto Rico that asks about the scope of the double jeopardy protection when a jury acquits a defendant of some charges and convicts on others, but the convictions are subsequently vacated. Early in the argument, the justices, led by Justice Kagan, pressed counsel for petitioners Bravo Fernandez and Martinez Maldonado about whether a jury's decision to convict should be ignored just because it was later vacated.
There are not many instances that we can find where we do look to vacated convictions for something or other. But in this case, the vacated conviction surely does tell us something about what the jury did do or what the jury didn't do. It's part of the factual picture. And so the question has to be, well, notwithstanding that, why shouldn't we look at it?
Petitioner's counsel, Lisa Blatt, worked to analogize this case to Yeager, the 2009 Supreme Court case involving a jury that hung on some charges. But she also highlighted the possibility of a middle path. The court could hold that a vacated conviction might be relevant to double jeopardy in some cases, but not others, depending on whether the reason for vacating may have impacted the jury's reasoning.
So I think for errors like Ferretta and Gonzalez-Lopez right to counsel and a few other kind of nutty structural errors where the court has never said they're prejudicial, but we're going to treat it as such because you can't unwind the apple cart. But for all other errors, including a biased judge, absence of counsel, a Brady violation, a directed verdict, a reasonable doubt instruction, they are prejudicial.
Petitioner's counsel also argued that the improper jury instructions that led to the vacated convictions made it impossible to tell whether the jury's verdict would have been inconsistent under correct instruction.
The instructional error, because of it, no one knows and no one can know why the jury convicted. And therefore, the defendants should not be put in the impossible burden of explaining inconsistencies in on a point that's not relevant to the acquittals. And so here's the example we gave in the brief, is that all 12 jurors, and this is the point of the error itself causing the inconsistency, all 12 jurors could have thought petitioners were not guilty of a crime of a quid pro quo exchange. And the only inconsistency is they were divided on whether there was a lawful gratuity. And so in that case, it's completely possible that the verdicts are consistent on the only relevant question.
Justice Kagan broadened the scope of the inquiry to the significance of a vacated conviction generally.
Well, maybe one way I can figure out the scope of your argument is just to ask, do you think that the government is always unable to use a vacated conviction that is for any purpose? Or do you think that the government is unable to use a vacated conviction only for double jeopardy purposes?
This court has never used a vacated conviction for any purpose, period.
Yes. So you have the history on your side, most of it. Do you think that that's because the government, cannot use a vacated conviction for any purpose?
Yes. I mean, since Blackstone, in the 1600s, when it's void ab initio, it disappears.
So this is...
Justice Alito drew a distinction between the legal effect of a vacated conviction and the historical fact that it occurred.
They lack legal effect. But it is a historical fact that it occurs, so surely they can be used to prove a historical fact.
The government's counsel, Elizabeth Preligar, later seized on this distinction in her argument.
It's certainly the case that a vacated conviction can't be used to establish the defendant's guilt of that charge. The fact that the conviction is vacated forecloses reliance on the conviction for that purpose. But we're not relying on the conviction for that purpose here. We're looking at it to establish only the jury's inconsistency. That's a historical fact. It's a matter on this historical record that actually occurred.
The government relied heavily on the fact that the vacated conviction demonstrated that the jury was inconsistent. But Chief Justice Roberts pushed back on this point.
If the jury relied on the part of the instruction that was legally invalid, then you don't know that they reached a verdict inconsistent with what was the acquittal in the prior case.
We can't rule
out
that.
A valid conviction.
That's true. We can't rule out that possibility, but it's equally possible that the jury validly convicted on a quid pro quo bribery theory and decided to acquit on the other offenses out of lenity or mistake or confusion.
Justice Kagan returned to the broader point about the use of a vacated conviction.
But it does seem, you know, quite out of kilter with the traditions of our legal system to use vacated convictions in a manner that affects individuals' constitutional rights. So I guess tell me why we shouldn't be concerned about that.
You shouldn't be concerned about it because the tradition is limited to looking at convictions to stand in for the defendant's guilt. And we acknowledge here that we can't rely on the convictions to establish that.
Well, I think the tradition goes further. I mean, you have a tough time in your brief coming up with any instances, and the only times you do are a couple of scattered lower court decisions. But you have, other than that, a really tough time coming up with any instances in which courts have used vacated convictions for any purpose.
It's clear that both sides see Yeager as the critical precedent, and the government worked to distinguish it.
But Yeager is fundamentally different because there wasn't a jury decision at all through the hung count, and so there wasn't anything that could actually create a true inconsistency with the one verdict in that case that the jurors had returned, the verdict of acquittal.
The government sought to tie this case to Powell, the court's 1984 case allowing inconsistent jury verdicts to stand.
Yeager distinguished Powell and said that when you have inconsistent verdicts, there the jury has spoken through its verdicts, and if it's reached contradictory results, then what we know is that that inconsistency exists as a matter of the record of the case. And Powell says that in a situation presenting that kind of inconsistency, it wouldn't be appropriate to assume that the verdict of acquittal is the proper verdict, the one that the jury really meant.
Another argument the government returned to several times was that the petitioners bear the burden of showing that double jeopardy should apply.
Ultimately, though, I think in light of that error, the appropriate result is the ordinary remedy here, a retrial. Petitioners are only entitled to avoid that remedy if they can carry their burden, and it's a stringent one, of showing that the jury actually resolved issues in their favor in this litigation.
Petitioners' counsel concluded with a strong rebuttal focusing on the long history of treating vacated convictions as nullities and on the essential similarities between this case and Yeager. Tuesday's second argument was Shaw v. United States. This is the bank fraud case that asks whether to defraud a bank, a defendant must be trying to obtain that bank's own property. Almost immediately, Justice Breyer launched into a ripped-from-the-headlines hypothetical about the theft of Kim Kardashian's jewelry, intended to explore the meaning of the word defraud.
If the local person comes to the door and says, "Dear Miss Kardashian, I am your local jewelry cleaner. Please give me your jewelry." She does. Ow.
Right.
And that's not fraud. He wanted to get the jewelry. He tried to get the – he also believed that the friend had just loaned it for the evening. That she's triple insured, that she won't even lose any money because the publicity will be worth it. Okay?
Right.
Now, my question is, there's the statute. I would have always thought from my first year in law school criminal law that that was fraud. But perhaps I was wrong, so I would like you to explain it.
Petitioner Shaw's counsel, Corin Bell, distinguished this hypothetical by pointing to the statute's narrow target.
That would be a scheme to defraud the insurer. And in this case of the mail and wire fraud statutes, which penalize a scheme to defraud anyone, for example, and provide heightened penalties for schemes that defraud anyone and happen to affect the bank, then yes, that would satisfy the statute. But if the statute specified a particular victim, as Clause 1 does here, and Clause 1 says the intended victim must be the bank, not the customer.
Shaw's counsel acknowledged, in response to a question from Justice Ginsburg, that the government could have convicted Shaw under a different bank fraud provision.
Do you recognize, do you concede that Shaw could have been charged and convicted under the obtaining property owned by or under the custody or control of a financial institution? If the government had charged that instead of defrauding a financial institution, could Shaw have been found guilty?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That was the appropriate charge in this case.
Justice Kagan worked to identify the precise disagreement between the parties.
Both of you are saying, look, there needs to be an intent to deceive the bank.
Correct.
And there needs to be an intent to deprive the bank of some form of property interest, but
Correct.
With the recognition that property interests include possessory interests as well as more classic ownership interests. And you agree with that?
Correct, Your Honor.
And I'm going to think, and Mr. Yang, you'll tell me, that Mr. Yang would agree with that, too.
Well,
so what are we fighting about?
Correct, Your Honor.
Then it's just Mr. Yang would say, well, look, a bank has a possessory interest in assets that are part of its depositor's account. And so, that's whether you target the depositor's account or whether you target something else, you're still manifesting the same intent to deprive the bank of a property, including possessory interest.
Some of the discussion focused on the specific jury instructions in the case, which required the jury to find intent to deceive, cheat, or deprive a financial institution of something of value. Justice Sotomayor summed up petitioner's argument.
And you're saying that by using the disjunctive, the or, the jury could have convicted merely for deceiving the bank, but didn't find that they deceived and deprived the bank of a possessory interest.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Justice Breyer wasn't convinced by this reading of the jury instructions.
It's not saying intends to cheat or deceive somebody, and then a separate thing, or deprive the financial institution of value. It's intend, it's to deceive, cheat, or deprive. Who? A financial institution. Of what? Of something of value. So what is wrong with that instruction? That's what I need explanation.
Yes, Your Honor.
During the government's argument, counsel for the United States, Anthony Yang, addressed the jury instructions.
It's all a question of whether deceive and cheat stand alone or if they're also modified by of something of value.
I think there's actually a deeper disagreement here. And I'm happy to talk about the jury instructions. And jury instructions, of course, have to be read as a whole. And when you read that, and particularly in conjunction with the materiality requirement, which is discussed in the material matter, you have to defraud the bank as to a material matter, and a material matter is one that has a tendency that causes the bank to part with money or property.
But Chief Justice Roberts questioned whether the Court of Appeals read the jury instruction the same way.
Just the instruction. It's what the Court of Appeals held. The Court of Appeals held, in short, as a quote, the defendant was guilty of bank fraud because he intended to deceive the bank. Full stop. So it's not just a problem with the instructions. It's a problem with what the Court of Appeals held.
The government urged a broad reading of the statute.
Now, there's no reason to add this additional intent knowledge about the property status of the thing that's being taken. It doesn't advance any interest that the Congress was trying to advance, was to protect the integrity of banks. The cost to the bank does not depend on what's subjectively in the defendant's mind about what they think. Is it owned by? Is it an ownership interest? Is it a possessory interest? Is there insurance? Is there not insurance? It depends on the nature of the actual scheme and what's being taken.
Justice Breyer questioned the government about what exactly the defendant needed to know or intend.
What you have to prove in respect to that property interest is in the defendant's mind.
And Justice Kennedy followed with a similar question.
What does he have to know about? Does he have to know that the bank is involved? I mean, what does he have to know about the bank?
The government responded that the required intent was minimal.
It just had to know it's taking something from this entity, which, in fact, again, is a bank under the statute. It could be a holding company. It could be any of these things. It's taking something from this entity by deceit, and that's the intent. Like, something of value from this entity by deceit.
Justice Kagan returned to the question of whether a mere possessory interest is enough.
Let me give you another example. Suppose that I'm sitting in a coffee shop and somebody comes up to me and says, I have to make a phone call. Would you just hang on to my computer for a minute? And then disappears. And then somebody else comes up, the fraudster comes up, and says, oh, she just told me to pick up her computer from her. And that's a misrepresentation.
Mm-hmm.
But I give him the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Have I had a possessory interest in that computer just because somebody said, why don't you take a look, keep your eye on this?
Yeah, gratuitous bailee is what they would be. And I think the answer is, I think we would say yes for purposes of the fraud statute.
During the rebuttal argument, Justice Sotomayor questioned whether Shaw's objection to the jury instruction was adequately preserved.
Assume I agree with you.
Yes, Your Honor.
That there were parts of your argument, both below and here in your brief, that suggested the instructional error But what I find is that the way you presented the argument was confusing.
Yes.
It took a lot of teasing out. How does that affect what we do?
Yes, Your Honor.
That you weren't clear in the instruction. Don't you forfeit that argument?
Shaw's counsel responded, attributing much of the confusion to inconsistent language in Hammerschmidt v. United States, a 1924 Supreme Court case that defined the term defraud. On Wednesday morning, the court first took up Salmon v. United States, the insider trading case asking what type of personal benefit a tipper needs to receive in order to qualify as illegal insider trading. Petitioner Salmon's counsel, Alexandra Shapiro, began by emphasizing the lack of statutory guidance about the definition of this crime.
In case after case, McNally, Skilling, and McDonald, to name just a few, this court has construed federal criminal statutes narrowly to avoid serious separation of powers and vagueness problems. This case presents those same constitutional concerns, but to a far greater degree because no statute defines the elements of the crime. The court should limit this crime to its core, as it did in Skilling. And that core is the insider's abuse of confidential corporate information for personal profit. Unless and until Congress enacts a definition, the crime should be limited to trading by the insider or its functional equivalent, where the insider tips another person in exchange for a financial benefit.
Justice Breyer suggested that helping out a family member could qualify as a personal benefit.
Why are the statute books filled with instances where the public wants to know not just how you might benefit, but how your family might benefit?
Well, Your Honor, the statute books are filled with rules like that, but Section 10B says...
No, I realize it doesn't, but I mean, I'm looking for the reason why. And, of course, I can suggest a reason, because they think very often, though it depends on families, to help a close family member is like helping yourself. Now, that's not true of all families.
Well,
but
Your Honor,
many it is.
And Justice Kagan cited language in the court's 1983 Dirks v. SEC opinion supporting that position.
So there's a lot of language in Dirks which is very specific about it's not only when there's a quid pro quo from the tippee to the tipper, but when the tipper makes a gift to the tippee, and in particular, a relative or friend.
Salmon's counsel argued for a bright-line pecuniary gain rule.
The point is that the line has to be clear, whether it's family or anyone else that the disclosure is being given to. And under the pecuniary gain test that we propose, certainly there will be many cases where the government can introduce evidence showing the kind of financial interdependence that will illustrate that the insider does benefit financially from the disclosure. I'm sure that's going to be true in most situations involving spouses and many other situations involving close relatives.
Justice Sotomayor pushed back against the idea that Congress had failed to adequately define the crime.
But Congress doesn't define what's deceptive or manipulative or what's the third word, what defrauds. It has general words. Don't devise a scheme that does these things.
Well,
the law has for ages said that the failure to speak when you're obligated to, i.e. an insider who doesn't disclose that he's using your information, is an omission. That's been classically a fraud. So I don't understand why you keep saying that the law doesn't define this.
But Salmon's counsel responded by citing the court's vagueness precedents and international analogs.
The Honest Services Fraud Statute talked about fraud, but it provided no specific guidance as to what would violate. And this court held that the statute needed to be construed narrowly to ensure that there was a clear line. Other countries have insider trading laws, and all of those laws use words like insider and define under what circumstances a person is violating the law by trading.
Salmon's counsel wrapped up by reassuring the justices about the effects of her proposed rule on the financial markets.
With respect to the integrity of the markets, getting back to your question, Justice Kagan, I think that that is clearly a policy question, and it is a very complex policy question. It is not nearly as simple as the government would like to have the court believe. And I think there's an extensive literature which is cited in our briefs and some of the amicus briefs, which illustrates that there's a robust debate among academics, regulators, market participants about whether insider trading should be regulated at all, but more importantly, to what extent, and how do you do that while ensuring that there's sufficient free flow of information to the markets that this information can actually work its way into the price.
During the government's argument, Chief Justice Roberts asked about line drawing.
Well, not everything is a gift just because it's disclosed. I mean, social acquaintances, you know, the people say, you know, we're all going away for the weekend. Why don't you join us? I can't. I'm working on this Google thing or something like that, and it means something to the other people. You wouldn't call that a gift. You'd call it a social interchange, and maybe it's, you know, something you should have been more careful about saying. But it's quite different than a gift, and it seems to me that however you read Dirks, it certainly doesn't go beyond gifts.
Justice Breyer had similar concerns.
The difficult part is for a personal advantage, at least to me. And the question is, what counts if the tipper gives inside information to a member, a family member, or friend? When is it for a personal advantage, and when is it not for a personal advantage?
Counsel for the United States, Michael Dreeben, argued for a very broad interpretation of personal benefit.
What is the personal advantage?
You have taken valuable corporate information, mm-hmm. and you're giving a gift of that information to a person to enable them to profit.
Okay, so what is the personal advantage that you received?
The advantage that you receive is that you are able to make a gift with somebody else's property.
Justice Sotomayor questioned whether the government's position would provide much clarity.
Mr. Dreeben, I'm not sure that your solution is going to clarify much of this area, because now I think the fight is going to be over what was the reason that the tipor gave for giving the tip.
Justice Alito explored this issue with a hypothetical.
Let me give you this example, because this goes to that. So the person with the inside information has had a few drinks at the country club and is talking to some friends and discloses the inside information to the friends. And one of the friends then trades on the information. Now, what would you have to prove as to the mental state of the tipper and the tippee? As to the tipper, would you have to prove that he knew that one of the friends would trade on the inside information, or that he was reckless as to whether the friend would trade on the inside information? He knew this was a person who was in the stock market. And as to the tippee, what would you have to prove? That the tippee knew that the insider knew that he was going to trade on the information? What would you have to prove?
As to the tipper, we submit that an element of the Katie Roberts duty is that the insider anticipated that the person to whom he gave the information would trade.
Chief Justice Roberts provided his own hypothetical.
What if you have a situation where, you know, close friends or whatever, and the one says, I want to tell you what I've been working on. It's pretty interesting. And tells him, he said, but whatever you do, don't go buy stock. You can't do that. That's against the law.
Right. And that is a situation.
So you're not going to prosecute that situation when the tippee goes and makes $100,000?
The tipper in that situation is disclosing information in the context where he has made an express statement, and I'm assuming understandings between the two, that the information would not be used. The tipper is not liable for insider trading. The tippee, who then trades, may be charged under the misappropriation theory for having taken information from a relationship of confidence or an express statement and an agreement not to use the information. And the fraud there is between the tipper and the tippee, not between, as here, the tipper and the people to whom the tipper owes a fiduciary duty.
Justice Kagan wondered whether the court could put off dealing with situations not involving a friend or relative, but the government resisted that dividing line.
And things might look different if we had a case that was not a relative or friend. And why not separate out that strange, unusual, hardly ever prosecuted situation and say we're not dealing with that here? We have nothing to say about it.
I'm fine with that. I mean, we are not seeking the court to go beyond Dirks. These are the cases that actually do arise in the real world. There is one case that involves a guy who was an insider who tipped his barber, and the district court said, well, the barber and the insider weren't close enough so that it didn't count under Dirks. I think that's wrong. I don't think that there's a good principle for it. But the court.
So is there a difference between friend and acquaintance, as you're talking? Tell me.
So this is precisely the reason why I think it doesn't make sense from a point of view of principle or application to draw a distinction that's based on words in the opinion that the court didn't actually articulate when it applied them to the very situation before it. There is more nebulous features about relationships once you confine it to undefined terms as friends or relatives.
The government concluded with a discussion of what a tippy needs to know to be guilty of insider trading.
And for a tippy like the one we're concerned with, the requirement is that that tippy know that the information came from an insider? Is that?
Yes, he has to know that it came from an insider in breach of a fiduciary duty and for personal benefit, as I've been articulating it. Conscious avoidance can be used to establish that knowledge. The person doesn't have to know all of the details of exactly what the breach of fiduciary duty was. There has to be enough information so that the government can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the tippee did know.
On rebuttal, Salmon's counsel argued that the government's proposed standard did not draw clear lines.
The example of the other insider also illustrates that sometimes it's not so clear whether someone has a corporate purpose or a personal purpose because sometimes purposes are mixed. In that instance, the insider was speaking with an analyst who was checking his financial model, and as the evidence in the case shows, this happens every day in the markets. The government argued that he was also seeking career advice from the other individual who was a college friend, but there's no indication there that he knew he was going to trade.
She then connected this argument to the specific facts of Salmon's case.
In this case, petitioner had no idea why Maher Kara was disclosing information to his brother. The only thing the record shows is that there was testimony that Michael told him the information came from the brother. There was no evidence he had any idea why, and as I believe Justice Sotomayor pointed out earlier, there were three different reasons at various points that information was disclosed. One was so that he could educate himself about the science of the work that he was doing. One was so that they could discuss potential drugs for their ailing father. And then there was the third phase. But there was no evidence whatsoever that petitioner had any idea why the information was being disclosed.
Wednesday's second case was Buck v. Davis, the case about ineffective assistance of counsel in capital sentencing. Early in the argument, Buck's counsel, Christina Swarns, emphasized Texas's unusual actions in response to the inappropriate expert testimony.
Texas acknowledged that its ordinary interest in finality does not apply. It publicly declared that it would waive its procedural defenses and allow new sentencing hearings in six capital cases, including Mr. Buck's, that involved the same expert's race as criminal violence opinion. Texas conceded error in five cases and then reversed course in Mr. Buck's case alone. As a result, Mr. Buck is the only Texas prisoner to face execution pursuant to a death sentence that Texas itself has acknowledged is compromised by racial bias that undermines confidence in the criminal justice system.
Early in the argument, Chief Justice Roberts addressed the case's complicated procedural posture.
In the question presented, you focus on the Fifth Circuit standard for a COA and saying they're imposing an improper and unduly burdensome. But most of the briefing, and as you've sort of begun today, is really focused on the underlying merits of the case. And you sort of have to make a choice, don't you? Because if we focus on the merits and rule in your favor, well, then we don't get to say too much about the threshold for certificate of appealability. Well, if we focus on the certificate of appealability, all we're saying on the merits is that there's a substantial showing.
Buck's counsel responded that deciding for Buck on the merits would also resolve the COA issue.
We believe that the district court's decision is wrong, and therefore Mr. Buck was entitled to a certificate of appealability.
Okay, so on the merits, then you just want us to say, oh, there's a reasonable jurist could disagree about whether or not he was unconstitutionally sentenced.
Or that that reasonable jurist would conclude that the district court's decision that Mr. Buck was not prejudiced was incorrect. And therefore, Mr. Buck was entitled to a certificate of appealability.
Buck's counsel had some difficulty convincing the court that his case could be distinguished from other ineffective assistance claims, but pointed to Texas's earlier apparent willingness to allow resentencing.
Particularly unique to Mr. Buck's case is where we have the state acknowledging that it has no significant finality interest in Mr. Buck's death sentence.
Chief Justice Roberts returned to the standard for issuing a certificate of appealability.
It's a unique case, so this would be an odd platform to issue general rules. I mean, in the brief, you say, well, the Fifth Circuit grants these in a very small percentage of cases. The other circuits are much higher. Mm-hmm. But if it is so unique, I don't know how we can use it to articulate general rules.
The Chief Justice asked whether the COA standard requires a court to engage in a more superficial inquiry.
Was it wrong for the Court of Appeals to conduct a merits inquiry in this case? I mean, they went to considerable length in trying to determine whether or not, you know, the claims were valid. Was that an error? Should they have just said, well, you know, the test is, what, a substantial showing, a substantial showing of denial? They should have just done, you know, kind of a sort of quick and dirty peek at the merits and saying, yeah, there might be something there. So right. did they err in looking at it more closely?
Certainly. This Court has made clear time and again that the COA analysis is a threshold review of the merits.
So should our decision be just that? They erred in looking at the merits. They should have just issued a certificate of appealability and send it back? That's not what you want, is
no.
it?
Justice Kagan helped Buck's counsel tie together the merits and the COA standard.
I would have thought that your answer would be that, you know, you think that this is such an extraordinary case and that the Fifth Circuit got this so wrong that it's the best proof that there is that the court is approaching the COA inquiry right. in the wrong way. If they reach the wrong result in this case, right. it's because they're just not understanding what the COA inquiry is all about.
Right. I mean, I agree. Absolutely. I mean, this the fact that this court found was unable to find these facts and circumstances debatable shows the fact that the Fifth Circuit is applying the standard incorrectly, for sure.
Justice Alito asked about the ineffective assistance test.
There was a lot of evidence, both relating to the offense that was committed and to other conduct by petitioner that would show future dangerousness. It didn't have to rest exclusively on this bizarre expert testimony. Isn't that correct?
There is certainly — the Texas certainly presented evidence of future dangerousness in this case. I think that, however, the heart of those that evidence was sort of the facts and circumstances of the instant crime, Mr. Buck's lack of remorse immediately after he was arrested for the instant crime, and the domestic violence incidents in the prior offenses. This court has recognized that aggravated crimes like this, like exactly like the kind we are talking about here, can and do trigger a racialized fear of violence that can yield arbitrary death sentencing decisions.
Buck's counsel concluded by emphasizing the importance of Dr. Quijano's testimony in context.
Dr. Lawrence presents evidence that the record is that Mr. Buck has a positive institutional adjustment history, that when he was previously incarcerated, he was held in minimum security. And that all of the crimes of violence that took place in the Texas Department of Corrections in the prior year were committed by people who were gang involved, and there was no gang involvement here. So Dr. Lawrence's testimony highlights the shortcomings or the limitations in Texas's case for future dangerousness, right? They say, here we do have evidence that goes beyond what Texas has presented. And what fills the gap for Texas? The only evidence that Texas has that says he will be dangerous in that context is Dr. Quijano's evidence that he has an immutable characteristics which establishes that he will be dangerous no matter where he is.
Counsel for Texas Scott Keller argued that Buck wasn't prejudiced by his counsel's performance, but Justice Ginsburg pushed back.
What counsel would put that kind of evidence before a jury? What competent counsel would put that evidence before a jury?
And we are not defending defense counsel's actions, but the nature of that claim is a Sixth Amendment ineffective assistance claim that the court also reviews for prejudice. In the context of a prosecutor offering the testimony and using it as an aggravator, that would be an equal protection and due process violation. And the nature of the evidence coming in that instance would be significantly highly prejudicial when the state is putting its imprimatur behind it and using it as an aggravator.
Justice Breyer asked why Buck's circumstances aren't extraordinary in context.
And Texas, in six cases, says this is totally wrong.
And now in this seventh case, you're taking the opposite position. And I have to admit, like what the Chief Justice seemed, I don't understand the reason. It seems to me it proves the arbitrariness of what's going on. But regardless, the issue here is there some good reason why this person shouldn't have been able to reopen his case?
Texas attempted to narrow the focus of extraordinary circumstances.
Well, insofar as the extraordinary circumstances analysis under 60B is being performed, I believe the Fifth Circuit was correct in that it would have to be an extraordinary circumstance justifying relief from the judgment. And when the facts of this case obviously have existed for over 20 years, there would be nothing new about raising that claim in a second Rule 60B motion to reopen the judgment.
Chief Justice Roberts returned to the distinction between the merits of the ineffective assistance claim and the standard for a certificate of appealability.
I mean, you argue that you should prevail on the merits. But the question on a certificate of appealability is whether there has been a substantial showing of denial of a constitutional right. Assuming you haven't already seen the analysis on the merits and you're looking at this question for the first time before going through this analysis, wouldn't it seem pretty straightforward to say, okay, maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong, but at least he's made a substantial showing? Let's give him the certificate of appealability, and then we'll go through the normal procedures on the merits.
Justice Kagan questioned whether the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is an outlier with respect to certificates of appealability.
You know, some of the statistics that petitioner have pointed us to, in capital cases, a COA is denied in 60% of Fifth Circuit cases as compared to 6% of 11th Circuit cases, two roughly similar circuits where COAs are denied in capital cases 10 times more in the Fifth Circuit. I mean, it does suggest that one of these two circuits is doing something wrong.
And Justice Sotomayor asked whether the fact that judges have actually disagreed has significance for the COA test.
It doesn't say anything to the Fifth Circuit that three state court judges, two of their colleagues on the Fifth Circuit, two justices of this court have said or found Mr. Buck's case debatable, because that's a standard. It's debatable.
Chief Justice Roberts explored the relationship between the underlying ineffective assistance claim and the Rule 60B6 extraordinary circumstances.
What is the relationship between the ruling on prejudice with respect to ineffective assistance and the 60B analysis? I mean, do you agree that if we disagree with your submission on prejudice under Strickland, that your 60B analysis kind of falls apart? Certainly the underlying claim on the merits would be stronger, and it would be a lot more extraordinary under 60B.
It is a factor that could be considered in doing the extraordinary circumstances analysis, because if there were extraordinary circumstances that were going to justifying relief from the judgment, that would be a factor in the totality of the circumstances the court could consider in doing that analysis.
Wednesday's third case and the final argument of the week was Manuel v. City of Joliet. This is the case that asks whether a claim for malicious prosecution can be brought under the Fourth Amendment. Early in the argument, Chief Justice Roberts asked Manuel's counsel, Stanley Eisenhammer, whether the favorable termination element of a malicious prosecution claim is consistent with the Fourth Amendment.
But favorable termination has nothing to do with the Fourth Amendment claim, right? I mean, whether your prosecution is favorably terminated or not, the Fourth Amendment claim, and it seems to me the accrual, begins when your Fourth Amendment rights are violated with, an illegal search.
But Justice Sotomayor took a different view.
If you have a corrupted legal process where what the independent adjudicator is looking at is not true because it's based on false information, have you received legal process, proper legal process?
You haven't received proper legal process. It's been — you're correct. It's been corrupted. Because —
and so I thought if you've never received it, then doesn't your time to accrue for the improper detention accrue when you're no longer detained? Here it was the not guilty, correct?
Correct.
In response to a question from Justice Ginsburg, Manuel's counsel explained why the statute of limitations shouldn't begin running until after release.
Why should the trigger for the statute of limitations be different just because we label this Fourth Amendment?
I think there's some good reasons for that. They were expressed in Heck, which applies in this particular case, too. You don't want to have parallel litigation. You don't want to have conflicting decisions between the state and a criminal court. And you don't want to have a collateral attack.
Justice Kagan asked whether the case should be remanded to the Court of Appeals to work out the scope of the claim in the first instance.
Oughtn't we to just send everything else back to the Seventh Circuit to decide what they think the Fourth Amendment claim looks like? In other words, what elements it has, what accrual date it has, anything that they think about this Fourth Amendment claim, send it back to them, having told them that they're wrong about whether this Fourth Amendment claim exists.
Manuel's counsel supported this proposal, but Chief Justice Roberts questioned whether it was feasible.
I mean, the alternative that is argued is that it's a due process claim. And whether or not they coexist or whether the particular period that you're complaining about is properly characterized as a detention without due process as opposed to a claim under the Fourth Amendment would certainly be pertinent in deciding whether or not to say there is a Fourth Amendment claim.
No, I think you can decide whether there's a Fourth Amendment claim or due process without referencing the statute of limitations. That issue is, in a sense, before you.
Next up was Alana Eisenstein, representing the United States as amicus in support of Manuel. Justice Breyer summed up the government's view on availability of a Fourth Amendment remedy.
A policeman makes an unreasonable stop and an unreasonable search, thereby violating the Fourth Amendment. Now, you can sue him, assuming you overcome other hurdles. Now he takes you off and puts you in prison, either with a magistrate or without a magistrate. And you are therefore being unreasonably detained. It's an unreasonable seizure pursuant to the Fourth Amendment. Therefore, it's a violation. Then you have a trial. And using the same rotten evidence, you're convicted. There you don't, though you could. But the reason that you don't is because you are viewed as, by the law so far, being in jail now as a result of your conviction. And the reason, I guess, is practical. We don't want to look into all those convictions and their different standards. Now, that's what's the framework in my mind. Is it right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is exactly the framework that the government puts forward, that it's not just the mere fact of being held in jail, but that the constitutional right depends on what process was infringed.
Justice Sotomayor explored whether the Fourth Amendment claim is properly characterized as malicious prosecution.
The question presented is, does the Fourth Amendment consonance house a malicious prosecution claim, which is something very different than what you're describing as a Fourth Amendment seizure and detention without legal process.
That's correct, Your Honor, because in our view, the constitutional inquiry is step one, but step two is to determine the elements and accrual date and other prerequisites to suit under a Section 1983 tort. And in that instance, the accrual may be governed by the closest common law analogy.
Chief Justice Roberts explored the relationship between the proposed Fourth Amendment claim and traditional common law malicious prosecution.
But it does seem to me to be just pretty result-oriented cherry-picking. If once you say, well, here's a claim, now we'd like the statute of limitations part, so we don't take that in. We don't want to have to show malice, so we take that. I mean, I don't know if we're still holding true to the approach in Wallace if you just start picking things in and out depending upon the demands of the particular case.
Well, Your Honor, I think that Wallace did say that federal accrual rules in particular were governed by the common law analogy. We think that that's as far as it goes in terms of choosing from the common law.
Counsel for the city, Michael Scodro, sought to reframe the case as not about whether the Fourth Amendment applies, but only about when the statute of limitations starts running.
I think it's essential to note we are not disputing at any point in this litigation, that misstatements made that result in a finding of probable cause at a Gerstein hearing is a Fourth Amendment violation. Nor does the Seventh Circuit disagree. The reason this came up to the Seventh Circuit as it did, and this may be important in understanding the context, this is on a motion to dismiss for violation of the statute of limitations. All of the claims were dismissed but one. The one that was appealed. And that one survived momentarily in the district court because petitioner claimed that that one claim has a favorable termination element because it is malicious prosecution.
Justice Breyer asked, if there is agreement that the Fourth Amendment applies, why shouldn't it be characterized as malicious prosecution with its favorable termination element?
Then the question is, do we use the malicious prosecution
right
as an analogy, not all the elements? And so now the question, great, this is fabulous, I get to the narrow question that I have, why isn't it a good analogy?
The city's council argued that the favorable termination element doesn't make sense as a matter of precedent or Fourth Amendment theory.
The delayed accrual principle and the favorable termination element that comes with it apply only where you have an extant conviction. And that doesn't exist here. The court went through a mental exercise. They said, look, if you can realize that you have a Fourth Amendment claim before you're convicted, if the elements can be in mind, you know you've been wronged in a Fourth Amendment way before you're convicted, then that is not a claim that is entitled to the delayed accrual principle of Heck. And the reason was very simple, because as this court said in Gerstein, Fourth Amendment contemplates that you can have bad arrests and good convictions. And nevertheless, the Fourth Amendment protects the innocent as well as the guilty.
The city's council kept returning to this theme.
The Fourth Amendment, this court has held, is there for the guilty and innocent alike. And in this case, the cost of borrowing that favorable termination element and importing it into a claim based solely on lies in an ex parte proceeding, which is what we're talking about with the Gerstein hearing, doing so would mean that if you're the victim of lies at a Gerstein hearing and you're detained, but ultimately you are constitutionally convicted as evidence amasses against you, the need to show favorable termination, it will be impossible for that plaintiff.
Counsel summed up the city's position in response to a question from Justice Kennedy.
Suppose you have arrest, Gerstein hearing,
yes, sir,
filing of formal charges, either information or indictment, pre-trial suppression hearing at which both parties are represented.
Yes.
And the false evidence is not its falsity has not been known, and so you're detained, and then trial. When does the Fourth Amendment violation end?
Sure. You would have it — this returns to Justice Ginsburg's point. You would have a Fourth Amendment claim for the initial warrantless arrest. You would have a Fourth Amendment claim for misstatements at a Gerstein hearing that then led to ongoing pretrial seizure. And the damages from that claim may run throughout the period of pretrial seizure.
And that's it for this week's oral arguments. Before hearing oral arguments on Tuesday and Wednesday, the court also issued a 71-page orders list on Monday. The bulk of this list consisted of denials of certiorari in cases considered by the justices at the September 26th long conference. The orders list also included a handful of GVR orders. This stands for Grant, Vacate, and Remand. The court GVRs a case when it believes there's been a change in the relevant law since the lower court opinion was issued. The most common reason for a GVR is a recent Supreme Court decision addressing the same issue as the lower court. The court grants the petition for certiorari and then immediately vacates the lower court opinion and remands the case, that is, sends it back, to the lower court to reconsider in light of the new Supreme Court case. These GVR cases don't get full briefing or oral argument at the Supreme Court, but are part of what is sometimes referred to as the court's shadow docket. Cases before the court that aren't part of its merits docket and don't get much attention. The court also issued various miscellaneous orders, including one in Murphy, Wisconsin, a case we described briefly in Episode 1, about whether contiguous properties with the same ownership can be combined for purposes of regulatory takings analysis. This is one of the cases that was granted back in January prior to Justice Scalia's death, but still has not been scheduled for oral argument, presumably because the court is concerned about a 4-4 split and is hoping for a ninth member before hearing the case. The court granted divided argument for the two respondents, Wisconsin and St. Croix County. Normally, when there are multiple parties on one side of a Supreme Court case, they will be represented by a single attorney at oral argument. Here, Wisconsin and St. Croix County, who filed separate respondents' briefs, asked to have separate representation at oral argument. Presumably, this is because the two respondents are staking out significantly different legal positions. The court also granted the Solicitor General's request to participate in oral argument and slightly expanded the argument time. So instead of the normal 30 minutes per side, the petitioner will get 35 minutes, and respondents' time will be divided with 15 minutes for Wisconsin, 10 for St. Croix County, and 10 for the SG. But though we now know how this argument will be divided, we don't yet know when it will be. Among the hundreds of cert denials was one of particular interest, Pro Football Inc. v. Black Horse. This is the case challenging the trademarks of the Washington Redskins under a provision that prohibits registration of disparaging marks. Last week, we discussed the court's cert grant in Lee v. Tam involving a challenge to the constitutionality of that provision by the lead singer of the Asian American rock band The Slants. Although the Redskins trademark case is still pending before the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, the team filed an unusual petition for certiorari before judgment in an attempt to get the court to take up its case along with Lee v. Tam. The court has now denied that request. Another notable denial was the denial of rehearing in United States v. Texas. This is the case in which a federal judge halted President Obama's Deferred Action for Parents of Americans immigration program. This case was before the Supreme Court last term, but the court split 4-4 and was unable to issue a decision. The U.S. petitioned for rehearing, but that request has now been denied. Finally, in addition to the certiorari grants and denials, 16 cases have been relisted for discussion at a future conference. Relisting is a sign that the court is interested, so it's a good bet that at least some of these cases will eventually make their way onto the court's docket. One of these cases, Elmore v. Holbrook, a case about ineffective assistance at capital sentencing, has now been relisted 7 times, but it's anyone's guess why the court is having such a hard time deciding whether to grant or deny this case. Now let's turn to this week's oral arguments. Because Monday is Columbus Day and Wednesday is Yom Kippur, the court's only oral argument day for the week is Tuesday, October 11th. The court is scheduled to hear 3 cases that day. The first is Samsung Electronics Co. v. Apple. This is a patent case coming out of Apple and Samsung's smartphone rivalry. The typical patents most people are familiar with are what is known as utility patents. Patents on a process or object that does something useful, like a new machine or a new chemical compound. This case, however, deals with the lesser-known design patents, which apply to ornamental designs applied to an object of manufacture. Just like with a utility patent, the owner of a design patent can exclude others from using the patented design. Apple owned several design patents related to the look of its iPhone and sued Samsung for infringing designs related to the physical shape of the front face of the phone and the layout of icons on the screen. After a trial, at least 11 Samsung phones were found to be infringing at least one of Apple's iPhone design patents. Here's the issue that's before the Supreme Court. The statute providing damages for design patent infringement makes someone who sells any article of manufacture to which an infringing design has been applied liable to the owner to the extent of his total profit. So, Apple says, Samsung sold an article of manufacture, those 11 phone models, that used Apple's design, so Apple is entitled to 100% of Samsung's profit from those phones. The District Court and Court of Appeals agreed and awarded Apple $399 million, Samsung's entire profit from those phones. Samsung says this is ridiculous. First, as a policy matter, it makes no sense. If Samsung's phones were found to infringe a utility patent, under well-settled law, the patent owner would be entitled only to the portion of the profits attributable to the infringed patent. Why, then, should a design patent owner get 100% of the profits from a phone that's built on hundreds of patents? Historically, Samsung argues, this provision was aimed at products like carpets and wallpaper, where the design was the whole reason to choose one product over another, not products with numerous useful distinguishing features. And second, Samsung argues that the statute can be interpreted to support its interpretation. Because this statute is about the use of a design, the phrase total profit could be construed to implicitly mean total profit attributable to the infringing design. Alternately, when the statute refers to an article of manufacture, this could be construed to refer to the specific component of the phone with the infringing design, not the entire phone. Apple, on the other hand, argues that the statutory language is clear and entitles the patent owner to the total profit, not to some apportionment based on the significance of the design. And although Apple agrees that the relevant article of manufacture for purposes of determining profits may be a component part rather than the final consumer product, in this case, Apple argues, the court below correctly found that the appropriate articles of manufacture were the entire phones. The Solicitor General has also been granted argument time in this case on behalf of the United States. The U.S. filed an amicus brief in the case not supporting either party. The U.S. agreed with Apple that the statutory language total profit doesn't allow apportionment based on the significance of the infringed design to the product. On the other hand, the U.S. argued that the case should be sent back down to the Court of Appeals to determine what the appropriate article of manufacture is. As the $399 million verdict in this case shows, there's a huge amount of money riding on the interpretation of this damages statute, and a number of amicus briefs have been filed on both sides by various industry associations and individual companies. Tuesday's second oral argument is Peña Rodríguez v. Colorado. This case pits a criminal defendant's right to a fair and impartial jury against long-standing rules protecting the secrecy of jury deliberations. In 2007, 2 young teen girls were confronted and groped by a man in a restroom at a horse racing track. The girls later identified Miguel Peña Rodríguez as the assailant. Peña Rodríguez insisted he was the victim of a mistaken identification and at his trial, a co-worker testified as an alibi witness, saying that Peña Rodríguez was working somewhere else at the time of the attack. The jury found Peña Rodríguez guilty of 3 misdemeanor charges, but reached no verdict on a 4th felony charge. After the trial, 2 jurors spoke with defense counsel and said that another juror had made several anti-Mexican statements during the course of jury deliberations, including that Mexican men take whatever they want, and they believe they could do whatever they wanted with women. This juror allegedly attributed his views about Mexicans to his experience as a law enforcement officer. The same juror also allegedly said that the alibi witness wasn't credible because he was an illegal, despite the witness's testimony that he was a lawful U.S. resident. Peña Rodríguez sought to use these jurors to challenge the verdict, but was barred from doing so by Colorado Rule of Evidence 606B, which explicitly prohibits using juror testimony about deliberations to undermine a verdict, with some limited exceptions. Colorado Rule 606B parallels Federal Rule of Evidence 606B, and the majority of states have comparable prohibitions on the books. Peña Rodríguez argues that here Rule 606B has come into conflict with the Sixth Amendment's guarantee of an impartial jury, and the rule of evidence must give way to the constitutional right. In 2014, the Supreme Court decided a related case, Warger v. Showers, which involved a civil lawsuit over a car accident resulting in a jury finding of no liability. After trial, plaintiff's counsel learned from one of the jurors that during deliberations, another juror, Regina Whipple, had revealed that her daughter had been at fault in a similar car accident, and that she believed her daughter's life would have been ruined had she been sued. The plaintiff sought to overturn the verdict on the grounds that Whipple had lied about her impartiality during jury selection. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously that Federal Rule of Evidence 606B barred juror testimony about Whipple's statements, and the court rejected an argument that this violated the plaintiff's constitutional right to an impartial jury. The court held that the right to an impartial jury was adequately protected by, first, voir dire, the process of questioning jurors about potential bias during jury selection, second, the possibility that bias would be surfaced during the trial prior to the verdict, and third, the possibility of non-juror evidence of bias. These are referred to as the Tanner safeguards, after the 1987 Supreme Court case Tanner v. United States, which involved allegedly intoxicated jurors. So, Warger v. Showers would appear to resolve this case, but the court in Warger's left itself an out. In a footnote, the court said, there may be cases of juror bias so extreme that, almost by definition, the jury trial right has been abridged. If and when such a case arises, the court can consider whether the usual safeguards are or are not sufficient to protect the integrity of the process. Peña Rodríguez argues that this is exactly such a case of extreme juror bias, so the court should take the opportunity to carve out an exception. He also points to the minority of U.S. jurisdictions that already allow juror testimony about this type of bias without apparent problems. Colorado argues that the Tanner safeguards are constitutionally sufficient to protect the Sixth Amendment right to an impartial jury, and also that the requirement of jury unanimity provides further protection against individual juror bias. On the other side of the balance, Colorado cites various interests served by Rule 606B, including encouraging unhindered discussion by jurors, preventing post-trial harassment of jurors, and protecting jury independence. Colorado is supported by the United States as amicus, making largely the same arguments. Peña Rodríguez focuses narrowly on racial bias as requiring a constitutional exception to Rule 606B, but both Colorado and the United States note that the Sixth Amendment's right to an impartial jury does not privilege racial bias over any other type of bias. To the extent that the court is sympathetic to Peña Rodríguez's request for a new exception, it seems likely that one major issue it will have to confront is how precisely to define it. Tuesday's third and final case is Manrique v. United States, a technical case about appellate procedure. Marcelo Manrique was convicted of possession of child pornography. The court entered a judgment sentencing him to 6 years in prison, but deferring determination of an award of restitution until a later date. Manrique promptly appealed the judgment. A few months later, the court held a restitution hearing and entered an amended judgment identical to the original except quantifying Manrique's restitution at $4,500. The amended judgment and records of the restitution hearing were included in the record on appeal, but the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals held that it had no jurisdiction to hear the appeal of the restitution order because Manrique had failed to file a new notice of appeal after the amended judgment was entered. Manrique argues that the 11th Circuit got it wrong, relying largely on Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4B2, which says that for a criminal appeal, a notice of appeal filed after the court announces a decision, sentence, or order, but before the entry of the judgment or order, is treated as filed on the date of and after the entry. Rule 4B2 protects a party who appeals prematurely. Technically, a notice of appeal is supposed to be filed after a judgment is entered on the docket, but sometimes there's a delay between a judge announcing a decision from the bench and the actual entry of judgment. Without Rule 4b-2, a party who filed a notice of appeal prior to the entry of judgment, perhaps moving expeditiously out of caution to avoid missing the deadline to appeal, might be out of luck because at the time of the notice there was no judgment to appeal. Manrique argues that in his case the original judgment without restitution merged with the later amended judgment with restitution, making his notice of appeal one filed before the entry of the judgment for purposes of Rule 4b-2, and therefore, according to the rule, his notice should be deemed filed as of the entry of the amended judgment. The United States disputes this reading of Rule 4b-2. The rule, by its terms, applies only to a notice of appeal filed after the court announces a decision, sentence, or order. But here, Manrique's notice of appeal was filed before the restitution hearing, where the judge first announced the amount of restitution due. Indeed, at the time the notice of appeal was filed, the only thing that could possibly have been appealed with respect to restitution was that some as-yet-undetermined amount would be due, as required by statute. The government also notes that unlike the scenario Rule 4b-2 was designed for, where the notice is filed before any final judgment existed, here, at the time of the notice, there was a final judgment, which Manrique's notice effectively appealed. It just didn't include the restitution amount. As a fallback argument, Manrique argues that even if Rule 4b-2 doesn't apply, because the timing of the notice of appeal is set by court rule and not by statute, it is not jurisdictional, and the Court of Appeals has the authority to look past a mistake under Rule 52A of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, which says that any error, defect, irregularity, or variance that does not affect substantial rights must be disregarded. The government replies that even though the timing of the notice is governed by rule, the requirement to file a notice of appeal is statutory and thus jurisdictional. Without a proper notice of appeal, the Court of Appeals has no authority to rule in Manrique's case. Furthermore, Rule 52A applies to errors in a judicial proceeding, not to a party's own failure to follow the rules. And that's the last of this week's oral arguments. On Friday, the justices will meet in conference to vote on these cases and additional cert petitions. There are no notable developments this week with respect to the vacancy left by the death of Justice Scalia or the stalled Merrick Garland confirmation. However, on October 4th, President Obama took to the pages of the Huffington Post to characterize Republican leaders' refusal to hold a confirmation hearing for Garland as part of a broader trend of obstructionism. Most of the justices have been seen out and about in the past week. Last Sunday, the annual Red Mass preceding the Supreme Court's term was held at the Cathedral of St. Matthew the Apostle in D.C. The service was attended by Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Kennedy, Thomas, Alito, and Breyer. The absence of the late Justice Scalia was noted during the ceremony. In the past, the Red Mass has occasionally given rise to controversy. Justice Ginsburg famously stopped attending after an anti-abortion sermon was given one year, but this year's Mass appears to have been free from drama. On October 5th, Justice Breyer was interviewed by Charlie Rose at the 92nd Street Y in New York as part of his ongoing tour promoting his 2015 book, The Court and the World. Video of the interview is available online. Then, on October 6th, six of the justices, all except Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Ginsburg, attended the dedication of George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School, named after the late justice following his death. Justice Kagan delivered brief remarks at the ceremony that garnered praise from admirers of the late justice. Finally, this week New Hampshire Public Radio aired an interview with Justice Breyer recorded before his appearance in Portsmouth to discuss his book on September 29th. As of right now, it doesn't look like any of the justices have scheduled appearances in the upcoming week. Next, some notes of interest for listeners. In conjunction with the start of the Supreme Court term, Fantasy SCOTUS opened its new term. Fantasy SCOTUS is a free online Supreme Court fantasy league that lets you compete against others for cash prizes by predicting the outcomes of upcoming Supreme Court cases. Also this week, the Harlan Institute and the Constitutional Sources Project announced their fifth annual virtual Supreme Court competition, which invites high school students to compete in an online moot court based on a current Supreme Court case. This year's competition is based on Trinity Lutheran Church v. Pauley, a case the court will hear later this year concerning whether a church daycare can participate in a state playground grant program. In commentary of interest this week was an interesting article by University of Michigan law professor Richard Primus at Politico magazine about how Justice Thomas may play an important role in shaping Justice Scalia's legacy through his use of Scalia's work going forward. And in other Justice Thomas-related commentary, Mark Pauletta, the creator of the JusticeThomas.com website collecting materials by and about the justice, has an article in The Hill criticizing the Smithsonian's new Museum of African American History and Culture for failing to include Justice Thomas, except briefly in the context of Anita Hill's sexual harassment allegations against him. Finally, a fascinating article this week in Time explores how Justice Ginsburg's accent has changed over the years in recordings from the Supreme Court. Ginsburg's Brooklyn accent, which is unmistakable in recordings from recent years, is much less prominent in recordings from the 70s when she appeared before the court as an advocate. This week saw a few more Supreme Court previews and events that are now available online. On October 4th, UC Irvine School of Law Dean Erwin Chemerinsky gave a preview of the Supreme Court term. Chemerinsky discussed 15 of the cases on the court's docket, as well as the court's future generally. On October 5th, Professors Josh Blackman and Eric Siegel debated the effects of the upcoming presidential election on the future of the court at Georgia State University. Finally, on the latest episode of the National Constitution Center's We the People podcast, Professors Daniel Farber and Barry McDonald discuss how Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump would shape the future of the Supreme Court. There's one more Supreme Court preview coming up this week. On October 13th at noon, the State and Local Legal Center will host a webinar on cases that the Supreme Court will hear this term of particular interest to state and local governments, featuring Wisconsin Solicitor General Misha Zaitlin, Deepak Gupta of Gupta Wessler, and Amy Howe of SCOTUS Blog. And that brings us to the end of Episode 3. Links to many of the articles, videos, orders, transcripts, and other resources discussed in this episode can be found in the show notes at countingto5.com. That's T-O and the number 5. If you have any thoughts or suggestions about the podcast, I would love to hear your feedback. Leave a comment on the show notes at countingto5.com or on the Counting to 5 Facebook page, tweet at countingto5, or send an email to mike@countingto5.com. I look forward to hearing from you. Tell me what you liked, what you didn't, what's missing, and how we can do better going forward. This podcast is a work in progress, and your feedback will help determine how it evolves. If you've enjoyed this episode, please spread the word. Tell your friends, share it on Facebook or Twitter, and please consider rating and reviewing the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you subscribe to or download podcasts. If you want to help ensure that this podcast continues, please consider becoming a patron. Visit Counting to Five's Patreon page, and for as little as $1 a month, you can help keep this podcast going. Please join me again next week when we'll wrap up the court's October sitting by recapping this week's three oral arguments. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.